Hello, this is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program or how it could be improved. And before I get started, I would like to wish all the listeners a very happy new year. And as I mentioned last week, I'm going to read articles from the January 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with a really long article about Neil Young's 2024's Archives No. 3 box set. And then the classic album review of New Adventures in Hi-Fi by R.E.M. And the article about Neil Young is titled My Way or the Highway. As 2024's Archive 3 box underlined, Neil Young's late 70s were as fertile as they were confounding. Entering his 30s in romantic and career turnaround, he hit a streak from Zuma to Live Rust, as brilliant and unpredictable as any before or since. Along the way, there'd be The Last Waltz, Like a Hurricane, and Eat a Peach. It wasn't about Neil trying to remain relevant, discovers Grayson Haver Curran. It was him trying to keep moving as fast as possible. In November 1976, just before the year slumped into the Christmas holiday season, Warner Brothers honchos came to visit Neil Young. He had become the label's most coveted rock star, not only able to dispatch albums to the top of the charts, but also make critics swoon. An intersection of prestige and profitability to which few of his peers could aspire. And he was famously mercurial, or perhaps intractable. Earlier that year, he'd bailed on a tour with Stephen Stills and one of the 70s most notorious kiss-offs. Dear Stephen, funny how some things that start spontaneously end up that way. Eat a peach, Neil. And suddenly, Warner Brothers' capricious star had a new vision, decade. The 3LB compilation he had spent more than a year building and annotating, and of which a few hundred thousand copies had been pressed, due in stores in days, would have to wait. What if I just save decade for a year, mused Young, maybe a day after turning 31, to Cameron Crowe. On the road with Young and Crazy Horse for Rolling Stone. It's not time to look back yet. Instead, he wanted to release an entirely new album, American Stars and Bars, a primordial country rock composite that, true to its name, suggested a wild night in some swampy dive. It could also be a vehicle for Like a Hurricane, a caterwauling theme of desperate desire. Young had cut a year earlier with reformed Crazy Horse. It should have its own album to be on, Young's fearless producer, David Briggs, recalled of the track in 1977, instead of being released with 32 other songs. And here is that song by Neil Young, Like a Hurricane.
Star, far across the moonbeam, I
Young used the bulky satellite phone on his beloved tour bus, Pocahontas, to call manager Elliot Roberts, the dogged enforcer of all Young's realizations. Roberts called Warner's 2 days later, label top brass Max Osteen and Ed Rosenblatt were on Pocahontas, hearing Young's new plan. In May 1977, American Stars and Bars was out. Decade finally followed that fall, almost a year behind schedule. As Briggs always told Young, be great or be gone. Decade was the perfect example of I can't get caught here. That's really looking back. That's three records of looking back, Crow tells Mojo nearly half a century later. Young had already compiled several of his hits for 1972's Journey Through the Past, then been drawn into 1974's So Far, a blockbuster pre-tour totem from Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. He's a single guy untethered by any domesticity, and he's a guy who had bad health as a kid and even into harvest, Crow adds. He seemed haunted within restlessness, but that all fed this forward motion of not wanting to get caught. These were the terms of what stand as the most productive and unpredictable half-decade of Young's career, rivaled only by the preceding 5 years. Just consider what he did between gathering Crazy Horse's second iteration to record Zuma in the summer of 1975 and the release of Rust Never Sleeps and Live Rust 4 years later. Tandem capstones for a tour that suggested new possibilities for massive rock shows. He issued his leanest and perhaps catchiest rock record ever, Zuma, and one of his most affable and accessible country records, Comes a Time. He found himself somewhere in the middle on American Stars and Bars, then helped invent the box set on Decade. He started a family in earnest, started a film that would challenge most every preconception of him, and started admitting that his generation of rock stars could not be gatekeepers forever. And he made at least one classic he kept to himself, the Full Moon Fever Dream, Hitchhiker. Young has been excavating this especially fertile span for years, with the release of Hitchhiker, the live opus, Songs for Judy, and the second volume of his gargantuan archives project. Stretching from 1976 to 1987, Archives Volume 3, ecstatically reviewed in Mojo 371, and this month confirmed among our reissues of 2024, makes his pace and power in the late 70s astonishingly clear. I'm not an artist who could remake Harvest or After the Gold Rush, he told a gaggle of foreign journalists a few months before that late-night call from Pocahontas. After Harvest, I was tired of being myself, always remaking the songs on stage, and becoming a kind of John Denver. I couldn't stay in this state, so I wanted to destroy this idea that I had of myself. The first half of the 70s offered a string of perilous young classics with five albums as rich and polarized as any other sequence in rock history. The cinematic pleas of After the Gold Rush gave way to the love and faint distrust of Harvest's folk rock and the brittle live document Time Fades Away, the narcoticized antithepy of On the Beach, an unrehearsed lecture on faithfulness, folly, and celebrity followed. A Kozik eulogy for innocence, Tonight's the Night, immortalized two of his fallen confreys, Danny Whitten, Crazy Horse's guitarist, and Bruce Berry, a trusted roadie. The wages of success were mixed. His songs chronicled the windfalls and losses. It's not like his art is separate from his life. It's one and the same with Neil, Elliot Roberts told Barney Hoskins in 1983. He's not like, I'm going to go to my room now and get the thesaurus, close the door, and get a couple for the band. The early 70s were a roller coaster for Young. Soon, after splitting with his first wife, Susan Acavato, when he was only 25, Young bought his longtime home in Northern California, the ranch Broken Arrow. But he soon found himself bound to a hospital bed at the Chateau Marmont. Pounding Michelob and muscle relaxers called Soma to alleviate a bad back. The combination is just unbelievable, he confided to Jimmy McDonald for the extensive 2002 biography, Shaky. He became enchanted by Carrie Snodgrass, an Illinois-born starlet who had shot to fame in Frank Perry's 1970 movie, Diary of a Mad Housewife. I was taking so much of the Soma compound that I could hardly move, he wrote in his 2012 memoir, Waging Heavy Peace. I liked her right away. Their relationship was contentious, with the trouble of two rising stars, compounded by endless allegations of infidelity and Young's ceaseless workload. They admitted they were too young to marry, but in September 1972, Snodgrass gave birth to Zeke Young. Diagnosed with cerebral palsy after early signs of abnormal growth and a series of seizures. I was never really happy during it, Young wrote of their relationship, with the excessive amount of analysis and psychodrama that was spawned, Snodgrass became the weighty cornerstone of Young's gnarled and bruised Ditch trilogy. As the relationship sputtered to its 1974 end, Young found himself drifting back to his past. Rejoining CSNY for a tour meant to capitalize on the arena-sized paydays of Bob Dylan's run with the band early that year. They tried to make new music together before a gargantuan tour that stretched from Seattle Coliseum to Wembley Stadium over two summer months. Their failure in the studio was a bad omen for what became known as the Doom Tour. Fueled by adverse and cocaine, than harmony or creativity. Stephen and Neil were punching well over 100 dB from their half stacks, Crosby remembered in Rolling Stone 40 years later, when authorized recordings of the melee finally surfaced. Graham and I simply couldn't do the harmonies when we couldn't hear ourselves. We did what we could, but I don't know how many people in the audience really got it. Young didn't evocate, listening back to the tapes of Wembley. It's pretty obvious that we were either too high or just no good, he wrote. I am saying too high. Another attempt to make a CSNY album that December ended in bickering about money and personnel. Just weeks earlier, Young had flown to Chicago to support Snodgrass after her mother, a serious alcoholic who had long teased her children about suicide, died. Young played at the wake and consoled Snodgrass, though he would soon tell her not to come to Broken Arrow for Christmas. With some downtime in Chicago, he booked a brief session at Chess Production Corp., the legendary studio on Michigan Avenue. He called Ralph Molina and Billy Talbot, the surviving rhythm section of his short-lived Crazy Horse. Talbot decided to bring the guitarist he and Molina had been jamming with in L.A., Frank Poncho Sam Pedro, a Detroit tough who had fled to California but continued to live hard. At rehearsal in Chicago, a cocktail of cocaine, heroin, booze, and bud coursed through his veins. I had no clue at all that those were the songs we were going to be recording the next day. And I was supposed to be learning, taking shorthand, and paying attention, he said in 2021. I was just going, I don't know if I like that one. That's hard. With Ben Keith on pedal steel, the song they cut, a Leaving Here country number called Changing Highways, was unremarkable. San Pedro, barely evident. The band panicked, convinced Young may never call them again. But Young felt something. It went well, he wrote. We rocked. And here's some of that Neil Young song titled Changing Highways.
Something graphic with my compass and my broom. I come in your room. Hello, hello. I love you, stranger. Is this our music up in your manger? And is this your?
San Pedro and the rest of Crazy Horse would gallop again, and soon. By late May 1975, they began gathering at Briggs' new place on Point Dune, a Malibu promontory that curls into the Pacific like a mitten. Briggs had rented a sprawling house there across the street from Goldie Hawn and not far from Bob Dylan, costing him $800 per month. At that first session, they cut Ride My Llama, a stomping curiosity about Young's ongoing fixation with the indigenous, and Cortez the Killer, a devastated anthem about emotional cruelty masquerading as a history lesson. They lost electricity as they recorded it, Young later remembered, but never stopped roaring. We lost a verse, he wrote. We cut it together with the missing verse gone forever. He must have sensed that Crazy Horse's essence, the institution of a few responsive players locked into a new song, had returned. They reconvened in early June and worked regularly through the month, inexplicably pounding away in Briggs' smallest bedroom, its windows lined with foam. Young would walk the 2 miles to the studio late each day, sweating out last night's party in the Southern California sun. Briggs had helped capture on the beach under the bewitching spell of infamous Honey Slides. Tonight's the night under clouds of grief, fury, and the great unknown. This was raw and honest, too, but it felt different because Young was different. He was single and back with his band. Neil was the happiest I have ever known him, Briggs said in Shaky. He was a great guy to be around. Zuma is an attempted and often exuberant expectation of Snodgrass. Young, bringing in buddies, old and new, to hammer home his farewells. Cut after Young inhaled a gram of San Pedro's cocaine, Stupid Girl is one of Young's most direct dismissals, brushing away beauty to be cruel, his voice wobbling and urgent. Young coughs up bar stool blues as an object lesson so that no one else becomes the old friend who trusts in love and loses. It is the rusted edge of goodbye. 3 months after Dylan and Young played together at a benefit for California schools, Dylan stopped by to jam, trying out some of his songs with Crazy Horse. They didn't work, and Dylan was one of many who subsequently told Young his new lineup couldn't play. Carole King wasn't impressed either. When Young played her Zuma, she had concerns. "This isn't a studio album," was how NME quoted her in 1982. "Neil, why don't you make a real record?" But there was a concession and clarity to Zuma, with Briggs having cleared the brambles from 10-minute vamps and Young having cut the track list in half. They canned, for instance, a genteel Pocahontas and a sluggish Powderfinger, landing on a 36-minute burst that presaged the rise of power pop, but affirmed the ramshackle band's improvisation-y vim. Time and again, during the last half century, San Pedro has said Young kept the song simpler for him at that point, as he learned his place in the band. "I was real timid around Neil during the Zuma sessions." It worked, as Ken Barnes put it in Photograph Record magazine a month after Zuma's November 1975 release. If becoming accessible again was Young's goal, he succeeded with a vengeance, and without sacrificing that cutting edge, or, as Young put it himself in Europe, "For tonight's the night, we did not consider the technical details. Zuma is relatively clean." Despite the criticisms of Dylan and King, Young made it clear that Crazy Horse was his band now. Soon after Zuma's release, they hit the road close to home, playing less than 10 shows in old wooden bars near Broken Arrow. They printed a few t-shirts for the Northern California Bar Tour, or, as it was jokingly called, the Rolling Zuma Review. The crowds barely broke 100, with all these people who live in the mountains and spend their money until drunk, Young soon said. "We come up and people scream." That backyard run was preparation for a month-long sprint through Japan and Europe. Young's acoustic solo set, chased by an electric one that tangled Zuma's best with songs from Crazy Horse's first phase. Emotionally charged, a Belgium newspaper proclaimed. The tour seemed to inspire Young rather than tire him. He and Briggs had started making late-night drives to Indigo Ranch, a sprawling and picturesque studio complex in Malibu that had been gobbling up the tube equipment Young loved as studio engineers flipped to solid-state technology. They'd often book time around full moons, a habit Young maintains half a century later. I noticed early on that a lot of my best recordings were cut on a full moon, he wrote in Waging Heavy Peace, and I started to make it a habit. On August 11, 1976, the moon was still waxing, 3 days shy of full. As the sun set, he and Briggs, in a 1959 Cadillac convertible, headed again for Indigo Ranch, with Young hoping to try a few songs that hadn't quite fit with Crazy Horse, and a few others, Captain Kennedy, Hawaii, A Beautiful Seesaw of Doubt, and Hope Called Human Highway. I smoked a little weed with the actor Dean Stockwell, and we settled into this small room, he later said. Dean drank a little tequila and sat in a chair that was established previously as being the quietest one. We were all feeling just fine. If Zuma's glorious racket had been about dispatching ghost through volume, this recording was about reckoning with the ghost that lingers, the past that haunts. "You ready, Briggs?" Young asked at the beginning of Pocahontas. For the next 34 minutes, past, present, and future tangle in a fever dream about how good what's to come could be in spite of how deadly, destructive, and desolate the past has been. A little cocaine goes a long, long way to ease that different load, Young sings during Hitchhiker, his taunt voice suddenly opening, "But that ain't all that I know." The reaction was that it was not a real record, but a collection of demos, Young remembered 41 years later, when Hitchhiker was released in 2017. A salvaged masterpiece, it testified to Young's magnetizing delivery and focus at that moment, plus his synergy with Briggs, who mixed it live in the next room. I was advised to record the song with a band. Before that could happen, however, Young had other obligations. At the start of 1976, Young had headed south to Miami, living in a houseboat on the docks of Coconut Grove. While recording with Stephen Stills at Criteria, the country's southernmost hit factory. But both process and result felt more like a favor for an old friend and bandmate who wasn't enjoying the same hot streak that a true partnership. Moreover, they were so seldom at Criteria at the same time that Atlantic president Almet Ertegun arrived to scold Stills. The album, Long May You Run, was a rare misstep in Young's 70s. Still, Young stuck to the plan, touring with a crack band until he left with his Eat a Peach dismissal. The Stills / Young tour is filler, Dave Marsh wrote in Rolling Stone after an early date, occupying space between more worthwhile projects for both men. Then there was Decade to finish, and as Young's 31st birthday neared that November, the Crazy Horse tour, during which he decided Decade must wait. He planned to end the run on November 26th, the day after Thanksgiving, with a show at Atlanta's Fox Theater. When the band asked him to perform on Thanksgiving at San Francisco's Winterland Ballroom during their final concert, he's scheduled 2 Atlanta shows on November the 24th. Staying up for days, he was so high and exhausted that he hallucinated seeing Judy Garland. "And I was still up when I got to the last waltz," he told McDonald. "I'm a bad druggie. When I do drugs, I do too many, and I'm all fucked up, and then I don't do them for a long time." Young shelved Decade, at least in part because he didn't want to saddle a new crazy horse scorcher, like a hurricane, with so much of his past. He'd need, then, some other songs. By March 1977, he had them. Linda Ronstadt had sung on Heart of Gold, and she opened for him during the 1973 tour that led to Time Fades Away. She had a new roommate, a Missouri singer named Nicolette Larson. They'd constantly harmonize with Adam Mitchell, the songwriter who shared their house in Tracas at the western end of Malibu. "We were two unhatched females on the road all the time, and that's a different life," Ronstadt tells Mojo. "We'd play in the sun together, get burned, go roller skating in Venice. We had so much fun, and we sang all the time." Lured by what Ronstadt and others had told him about Larson's voice, Young showed up at their door for an impromptu recording session on March the 1st. Finally released on the 4th disc of Archives Volume 3, subtitled Snapshot in Time. On the evidence of the first song they cut, a version of Long May You Run, Ronstadt and Larson instantly cozied up beneath Young's singular tone, slipping around him with harmonies as wistful as the lyrics themselves. They're as masterly on Hey Babe, the day after writing it, Young sounds like he can barely remember the rhythm, but Ronstadt and Larson pull up its chorus like puppet masters. On tape, they call the lascivious Bite the Bullet obnoxious, which Young rebuffs, while their background coos during Hold Back the Tears prompt Young, mid-song, to offer a satisfied, "Yeah." And here's a little bit of that song, Hold Back the Tears, by Neil Young. A month later, Ronstadt and Larson, as Young called them, the Saddlebags, a nickname that still makes Ronstadt chuckle, headed north to Broken Arrow for a 3-day stay. "We slept late and we worked when the mood struck him," says Ronstadt, remembering that they would ride horses during the day and that she would jog 3 miles through the forest. And the food was good because those guys could all find some girl who could keep the food rolling. 6 weeks later, six of the songs the trio rehearsed in Malibu and cut at Broken Arrow were out. On the first side of American Stars and Bars, Young could release it so quickly because its back half pilfered his archive. A jubilant, crazy horse hymn to backyard produce of any kind. Homegrown and an aching country number graced by Ben Keith and Emmylou Harris, Star of Bethlehem, and, of course, there was Like a Hurricane. Its lyrics first scribbled onto a newspaper in November 1975 during a scenic cocaine-snorting stop between dive bar dashes. Doctors had removed nodules from his vocal cords that summer of 1975, so he couldn't sing it straight away. At Broken Arrow, for more than a week, Crazy Horse couldn't play it either. At the end of a day of getting nowhere, Sam Pedro sat behind a Krumar Stringman, an early string synthesizer then only a year old. It clicked. When engineer Briggs and Tim Mulligan heard the band strike up, they pressed record. If you listen to the take on the record, said Sam Pedro, there's no beginning, no count off, it just goes woom. American Stars and Bars bridged Young's two primary 70s modes, the rich country rock of Harvest and the splintic, unguarded howl of Crazy Horse. That synthesis set an important precedent for what was to come. The delay to Decade, which arrived in October, was ultimately more than justified. There was, however, one critical aberration, Will to Love. In early 1976, Young sat by the fire at Broken Arrow late one night before an early morning flight to Miami to work with Stills. He recorded himself singing a parable about blessed perseverance, epitomized by an ocean fish who swam upstream. Back in Malibu, sometime after the Stills Young Band session, he took it to Indigo Ranch for another late-night Briggs rendezvous. As Briggs manipulated the tape, Young shifted between drums, vibraphone, and bass, conjuring a faint symphony of overdubs. As warped and weird as it's imaginative and absorbing, Will to Love suggests new possibilities for making records alone. That was the perfect way to work. Get it all at once, Young wrote by way of eulogy for Briggs. Put it on tape and mix it immediately while the image is fresh. Young got restless again in the summer of 1977. American Stars and Bars had been out for only 2 months when whispers about Young began circulating in Santa Cruz, a laid-back shoreline city south of San Francisco and not far from Broken Arrow. He was, rumor had it, starting a new band there with some locals and Bob Mosley, who had just left Moby Grape. They called themselves the Ducks, with Young dubbing his trusty Packard the Duckmobile, a cantering country rock band with occasional splashes of soul and surf rock. The Ducks played local bars for small crowds, much like Young had done with Crazy Horse 2 years earlier. Their 7-song appearance on Archives Volume 3, Disc 5, subtitled Windward Passage, is pure pleasure, no pressure. I'm starting to get back that certain feeling for playing my music, Young told the local paper, Good Times. We're in a place right now where we're pure. It's like being born again. But Young split that September, leaving his beach bungalow in Santa Cruz for sessions in Florida and Nashville with aces including Ben Keith, drummer Carl Himmel, and keyboardist Spooner Oldham. These sessions are the stuff of Disc 6, Oceanside / Countryside, one of Archives Volume 3's True Troves. The Ducks weren't invited, but their easygoing essence infuses many tracks that became 1978's Come a Time, his most accessible album and the closest he'd come to country rock since Harvest. Ronstadt had warned Larson against a romance with Young. Since the songwriter was not living in the real world, related Young decades later. I don't remember saying that, but it could be something I would say, says Ronstadt now. None of us lived in the real world at that point. Nevertheless, they did get involved and their voices blend perfectly on Comes a Time, an album with lyrics that often mirrored Ronstadt's caution. I know things are going to change, he sings on Look Out for My Love, one of two songs cut a year earlier with Crazy Horse, but I can't say bad or good. He was right. Neither the relationship with Larson nor the stately country mood would last. Both were already fading by 1978. As perfect a record as I can make is like a Harvest or a Comes a Time, and two's enough, you know? He eventually told disc jockey Mary Turner, maybe in 5 years I'll try another one like that, just to convince myself I can still do it. Sometime during that restless 1977 summer, Young encountered Devo, nerdy and nervy Ohio punks who had come west expecting a record deal that didn't materialize. Through a string of friends, a copy of their 1976 short film, 9 minutes stuffed with two snappy songs, biting social commentary, and imaginative editing, made it to Young. He loved it. Then he saw the band. We thought Neil Young would have hated us, but we were totally wrong, Devo's Gerald Casal tells Mojo today. He was like an excited teenager, totally into what we were doing. It seemed like we had sparked something in him, like he was looking for a way to get excited about music again. Young asked if Devo would be in his film, an apocalyptic nuclear comedy called Human Highway. While Young headed for Nashville to record Comes a Time, Devo headed to New York, where they were courted by David Bowie during a coup of a concert. When they rendezvoused to work on Human Highway that spring, Young spotted a T-shirt Casal and bandmate Mark Mothersbaugh had printed for Rust-Oleum, a Midwestern company that made industrial coatings. He lost it, Casal remembers. Young suddenly had a mantra. I can relate to Rust Never Sleeps, Young told Mary Turner. The longer I keep on going, the more I have to fight this corrosion. Now that's gotten to be like the World Series for me. Whether I will corrode and eventually not be able to move anymore and just repeat myself until further notice, or whether I'll be able to expand and keep the corrosion down. Just weeks before starting his 1978 fall tour with Crazy Horse, he decided, of course, to aim for the latter. Sure, he was already busy, set to marry Peggy Morton, a local waitress he had long courted, that August. Their first child together was due in November. But while on his boat, the W.N. Ragland in the Grenadines, Young fervishly sketched out a conceptual concert called Rust Never Sleeps. in a pocket notebook, massive amplifiers and microphones, roadies dressed like Star Wars Jawas, but called Rode Eyes, a cameo by a pretend Devo. He and Crazy Horse would mostly eschew Comes a Time material to barrel into several unreleased songs, making an album as they went. It would become Rust Never Sleeps, largely built by editing live takes and adding overdubs. A perfect synthesis of the political and the poignant, the acoustic and the electric. The album offered a culmination of everything Young had done in only 9 tracks. Nearing 34 when it was released, he was now a surviving statesman of rock, able to deliver its reigning existential conundrum. It's better to burn out than to fade away. Young had started the tour with boyishly short hair, his long hippie swept suddenly gone, and just as the tour ended with dual shows at the LA Forum, wildfires incinerated his Malibu house. It was as if the full moon had marked the end of another cycle, the energy shifting again. People don't understand sometimes how I can come in and go out so fast, how I can be there and want to do something, and then when it's over, for me, it's over, he told Crow. I just don't like to stay in one place very long. Young's last album of the most profound decade of his career was an appropriate one. Released just 6 weeks before the 80s began, Live Rust, a 70-minute double LP that chronicled 1978's landmark tour, was nearly twice the length of its predecessor, despite a lack of new material. Looking back at his recent past in 1976 for Decade, Young had veered left with American Stars and Bars. On Live Rust, he dove right into such a document. These are adequate live versions of songs that don't need reproducing, Max Bell marauded in NME. Everybody stomps, rock and roll, etc. Who needs it? During those feverish days of late 1976, after he'd bailed on Stills and returned to the road with the horse, he opened each night with an inspired acoustic set. The old songs had a new edge, while the unleashed songs, Pocahontas, Campaigner, Give Me Strength, suggested his steady search for something more, not content with what he'd done during his first 3 decades. He acknowledged turning 31 with a joke about Baskin-Robbins' 31 flavors for ice cream. I love it when you ask me for those old songs and everything, but it's funny because what keeps you alive is what kills you, you know, he says at the start of Songs for Judy, clearing his way into the unknown. Too much of the old shit, you know, good night. During the tour, photographer and guitar tech Joel Bernstein recorded each show on his new Ober cassette deck for his amusement. When the run was done, he and Cameron Crowe picked their favorite iteration of each acoustic number, compiling what became known as the Bernstein tapes, when their mix finally leaked. Just what I'd been trying to avoid, Bernstein wrote in the liner notes for Young's official version in 2018. Still, it was an unguarded statement of an artist in constant motion, dodging the rust. In fact, Crow sees it now much as he saw the decision to postpone Decade on that very tour. Young's lifelong health struggles have made him especially aware of his mortality and how there may be less time to move forward than he hoped. He would soon slow down with marriage, fatherhood, and record industry woes, collectively redirecting his attention in ways he could have barely anticipated on his 31st birthday. Back then, the future was still one vast possibility, a place to burn out rather than fade away. It wasn't about Neil trying to remain relevant, says Crow. It was him trying to keep moving as fast as possible to use the time in the most productive way, to keep pivoting and shape-shifting. That's what that period is. And now it's time for the classic album review, and this week it's R.E.M.'s New Adventures in Hi-Fi. Say You're R.E.M. By the mid-1990s, you've become one of the biggest rock bands in the world. What's your next move? Leaning into stardom and teaming up with a big-name producer? Retreating from the spotlight and then breaking up? Or doing something ambitious, unusual, and completely unexpected? If you guessed the latter, you'd be right. In a move that now feels very in character with hindsight, R.E.M. decided to write and record most of a new album while on the extensive world tour supporting 1995's global smash, Monster. Breaking up the monotony of concrete arenas and daily sound checks with songwriting, the resulting album, New Adventures in Hi-Fi, newly released with a companion album of bonus material from the time, is a batch of scribbled postcards from the road, chronicling bursts of grief, alienation, inspiration, and optimism. As might be expected, New Adventures in Hi-Fi is the most eclectic R.E.M. album, while Bittersweet Me is immediately recognizable as an R.E.M. song. Credit Peter Buck's melancholy guitar epipelagos, and So Fast So Numb is a raging rocker. Other moments are surprising. Leave is dominated by urgent, harsh synth that revolves like a screaming siren. Be Mine is lovely, lo-fi fuzz rock. Low Desert is a bluesy, dusty roadhouse blues dirge. And Ebo, the letter, a meditative expository featuring the somber invocations of guest Patti Smith, is its own genre, drawing on gentle guitar jangle, electric sitar, and mellotron for chamber music-inspired beauty. And here's some of that song, Ebo the Letter, by R.E.M.
Some of them they surprise. The bus rider went to write this 4 a.m. this letter. The fields of poppies, little pearls. All the boys and all the girls, sweet tooth, each and every one a little scary. I said your name. I wore it like a badge of teenage film stars, hash bars, cherry mash, and tinfoil tiaras. Dreaming of Maria Callas, wherever she is.
Although the lengthy Monster tour was marred by unforeseen medical issues, including drummer Bill Berry having a brain aneurysm on stage during a show, the album itself doesn't show these fissures. Instead, Stipe's lyrics are inward-looking and meticulous, loaded with striking abstract imagery. Aluminum tastes like fear. Adrenaline, it pulls us near. From Ebo the Letter, and songs that grapple with identity, geography, and finding a place in the world. New Tess Lepper is a deep moving song describing a sincere guest being shut down while trying to put their authentic self forward on a tabloid talk show. How the West was won and where it got us obliquely addresses historical turmoil that helped shape the country's direction. Here's some of How the West Was Won and Where It Got Us by R.E.M.
Water from the wrong place, wrong time. There's flyers out of...
Our takes on the Murky Undertow and the Jagged Departure illustrate what a great live band REM was in the mid-1990s, while shedding light on new adventures in hi-fi's immediacy. Organ-heavy live versions of The Wake Up Bomb and Binky, The Doormat, possesses freewheeling glitter-glam hearts and serve as a bridge from Monster to the new era. And a delicate alternate take on Leave removes the siren-like keyboard and replaces it with a moody, percussion-speckled ambient backdrop. The somber vibe underscores the song's deep longing and new adventures in hi-fi's brittle poignancy. Here's some of the song The Wake Up Bomb from REM. And unfortunately, once again, we're all out of time. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the January 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with a Mojo interview with Gillian Welch and David Rawling, and a review about the Bob Dylan movie titled A Complete Unknown, classic album review of Young Americans by David Bowie. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music, wishing everyone a happy new year and to keep on rocking.